Good morning. If it may please the court, I represent Roosevelt Powell. My name is Brian Truitt. In evaluating this case, as it relates to Roosevelt Powell, I submit, or I believe, that it is important to recognize that the two defendants in these cases are very separate and distinct as far as their actions and their positions in the conduct. There is not much dispute as far as what actually occurred by each individual actor. My client, as I put forth in my second argument, and leaving aside for the purposes of my oral argument whether or not a fraud against the Gary Historical Society ever existed, simply put, our position is that my client was in no way a knowing participant.
But there was evidence, was there not, that he used his U.S. research business to obtain a reduction of taxes on the property on the very date of the sale by, you know, misrepresenting the status of that property to the court. And that reduction increased the profit from the sale to each of the participants in that, in what turned out to be a fraudulent scheme. Wouldn't that be all that would be required to support a determination that he participated in the scheme to defraud?
Is
that what you don't want to talk about?
Well, I did not challenge that because clearly by the standard of review, if a reasonable juror believed Peggy Katona, the conviction would be upheld. We submit that there was nothing nefarious in it. However, I cannot with a straight face argue to this court that it should be reversed on an insufficient evidence. Number one, that was a separate and distinct act. Secondly, it did not in any way increase my client's profit. Certainly there is no evidence of that as far as his commission for brokering the sale on both the seller and the purchaser side. The money that he received was $25,000, which is consistent, maybe not exact, with the realtors that had previously listed the property and the realtor who sought out the sale of the property after the GHS had obtained possession of it or ownership of it. It certainly at least was not usury. It was very consistent, a 12.5% commission. And clearly the evidence, and I don't think there's any dispute in the evidence, that my client did a significant amount of work towards the sale of the property. The reduction in property taxes, which is the 18666 count, actually benefited, or should have benefited, the Gary Historical Society. My client had until the trial, had no idea, and there's no evidence, that he knew how the proceeds of that sale were put up. He received a trust account check from Willie Harris's trust account, which it would be consistent. If be it a personal injury case, a real estate case, I would deposit a check in my trust account. I would pay lien holders or who I had to.
Are you arguing that it's just pure serendipity, for instance, that Mr. Powell arranged for the lawsuit to be filed on the date of the property purchase? Because that's what resulted in a same-day reduction.
Your Honor, it may be
from $73,000 to $15,000.
And of course, there was the initial indictment claimed $38,000 in taxes. Your Honor, I don't mean to be flip, but it may be that simple that it is serendipity.
But could I just interrupt? Sure. You said something a minute ago that I guess confused me, and I wanted to clarify. Are you in fact making the argument that the evidence was insufficient to support these convictions? I know we're not talking about the tax conviction right now. We're talking about the scheme to defraud. Are you making an insufficiency argument?
Yes, as I state my issue heading, as to count one, which is the wire fraud count, I am not making any argument to overturn because I don't think I can, the 666 count, which is the tax reduction. So, yes, as
okay,
far as...
Okay, so it's specifically with respect to count one, because I, with respect to count one, I guess, obviously the evidence is circumstantial, but it seems that a rational jury could see the evidence in a way differently. Maybe a jury could have seen the evidence the way you're describing it as well, but I don't know why they had to.
Well, Your Honor, the case that I cite, which is was one that I came closest to what I could find, and maybe that speaks to my research abilities or lack thereof, is a Tenth Circuit case, which I cite on page 28 of my brief. And the Tenth Circuit in that case found the evidence sufficient that there was indeed a fraud that existed, that three of the defendants knowingly engaged in that fraudulent conduct, but that the fourth defendant, as a matter of law, the evidence was insufficient that he was a knowing participant in the fraud. That even though his actions ultimately benefited the fraud couldn't have succeeded without his actions, he was not a knowing participant, and that the jury did not have sufficient evidence to sustain that conviction. I'm sorry, my light is on.
You know you have 4 minutes rebuttal.
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning, Mr. Drake.
My name is MacArthur Drake, and I represent the co-appellant in this matter, Willie Harris. Judges, matters, in addition to fraud, of course, includes and conspiracy, which we do contend there's insufficient evidence of. There's another a caveat I'd like to point out. There was a third defendant, Will Smith, who was charged in count one, and I think it's counsel for the co-appellant has mentioned. A number of the acts was certainly separate and distinct. There was certainly no overwhelming evidence that everything that was done in concert.
Now, if Mr. Harris concealed from the Historical Society that had owned the building and concealed the amount for which it was sold in order to keep a large portion of the profit for himself, wouldn't that be enough to constitute fraud?
Judge, we believe the evidence, I guess, even in the light most favorable to the to the decision and to the government, is still insufficient with regard to that concealment.
But what's the answer to Judge Rovner's question? I mean, if the jury had seen things as she just described, would that have been enough to show fraud?
Well, if the jury had, if the jury conceded that, concluded that that was that there was absolute concealment, and that there wasn't authority, in other words, the agency role that Mr. Harris played, that is clear from this evidence with regard to the Historical Society.
So is that a yes answer or a no answer? So if the jury had looked at this evidence, had looked at the testimony from Millinder and the others, and had concluded that concealment was going on, and I'm not even going to get to the question about this whole concept of loaning your 501c3 status to somebody, which strikes me as pretty questionable too. But if had they seen the concealment, why isn't that enough to support fraud?
Well, Judge, that may be. I guess
couldn't they have believed Ms. Millinder that she was being that her signatures in some instances were forged, and that in other instances she was simply trusting people and signing things without understanding the full import?
Yes, Judge. We think if there were certain other things that were in place. We think that by itself, it certainly may constitute that the jury believe that some sort of misconduct and maybe some sort of a criminal misconduct. However, that's not the only thing that the jury would have to believe in that regard. The government's position was, Judge, we believe that these three defendants acted in concert one with the other to pull off what the, you know, what the government and the court has concluded was
why,
fraud.
Why isn't the evidence of the way that that $200,000 was split up some evidence that they were working together? They leave $50,000 with the Gary Historical Society, and they divvy up amongst themselves the other $150,000.
Judge, it seems like the presumption is because the part that did not go to the Historical Society creates some sort of per se violation of the duty of the agent.
Well, it suggests that they're working together at a minimum. I mean, you don't just pull people off the street and say, here's $75,000. I mean, they're working together.
Yes, when you say together, it would be together, I would think, in the sense that when real estate transactions take place around the country every day, there are real estate agents, there are lawyers, there are persons involved in a closing, for instance. They aren't conspiring, I guess, and I think that would be the difference. They may be acting separately, but at this particular point, their roles overlap. And that's the part we think there's no evidence of a conspiracy on. Because they were in the same room, we think doesn't mean that they were conspiring, even though they were there for a common purpose at that point, and there may have been some other points. They were also, their paths overlap. But Judge, also, defendant Will Smith was acquitted of the conspiracy. A number of the contentions involved the conduct of Will Smith. As the court mentioned, the use of the 501c3 was strictly, based on all the evidence, something between defendant Will Smith and Ms. Dolly Milliner. That there's not one scintilla of evidence that Willie Harris engaged in with Mr. Smith in buying the use of the 501c3. For $50,000. We think that without Will Smith, then having been acquitted, not just having been an unnamed conspirator, he was.
I wouldn't place too much weight on that acquittal. First of all, the law doesn't place any particular weight on it. It may mean that the jury had some reasonable doubt, but not enough to prevent it from finding that Mr. Harris and Mr. Powell conspired, maybe even with Mr. Smith. I mean, that's possible.
Yes.
Maybe they didn't think he used the wires. I don't know. I mean, there are different possibilities.
Yes. We just think that once you take away some of the conduct of Mr. Smith, in particular, the purchase of the 501c3 status, that takes out a great deal of the government's case. And when there's no evidence that, for instance, the other two defendants had anything to do with that. There was some business use made of it later, apparently. But, Judge, the other thing we'd like to point out, however, is the defendants were each charged with individual tax counts. And with regard to Mr. Willie Harris's tax count, Judge, was that he filed on the wrong form. He filed he did not fail to report the income. He failed to report it. It's capital gain. Instead, he put it as general income, and in fact, the record shows that there was a tax disadvantage for him to do that.
That was in his amended return, wasn't it?
He later amended the return to file it on put the capital gain on Schedule D, mm-hmm. and got a refund. In other words,
all right, the taxes are a lot lower on capital gains than they are in regular, aren't they?
That's true. Judge, and we think that indicates on the issue of intent that there was no intent by shown by this evidence of Mr. Harris to deceive the government with return with regard to his income from that transaction. He reported that. He reported it to his disadvantage on Schedule C. If I could, I'd like to reserve a little time.
Good morning. My name is Gary Bell. I represent the government. I work for the United States Attorney's Office, the Northern District of Indiana. I was also the trial counsel, and what I'd like to do is point out some of the facts, and I'd like to talk, first of all, Mr. Drake's last remark about the tax return, Mr. Harris's tax return. I don't believe the record supports that Mr. Harris filed an amended return. it does support that Mr. Powell filed an amended return.
But why was the government prosecuting him for paying too much tax? I mean, he puts this on Schedule C instead of Schedule D, and what difference does it make? People make mistakes like that every day. They're innocent mistakes. They pay at the regular rate as opposed to the more preferential capital gains rate.
Your Honor, I don't think the record really supports that he, in fact, did pay the taxes on that transaction. If the record shows that we attempted twice to gain or obtain the accounting schedules from the law firm, the first time they weren't provided, the second time they were provided, but they were only provided after the indictment. And if you look at the record carefully, there was cross-examination of the of Mr. Harris's accountant, and both Mr. Harris's accountant and his wife testified that the schedule that was provided should match the bank deposits, and we carefully went through and compared the bank deposits to the schedule itself that they claim showed the income had been reported. In fact, the schedule was much different than what the bank statements showed. So what I would suggest to the court is the information that they brought into trial wasn't, in my mind, accurate.
So you think the jury was entitled to find on this record that it really wasn't, in fact, on any schedule, C, D, or
correct,
on out through the alphabet?
Correct. And then I would also suggest to the court that the failure to report the transaction, which was the sale of the property on Broadway, should have been reported on as a scheduled, as a capital gain. I can't remember if that's a schedule
that's
C or
D.
A D. Thank you. As our agent testified, it's important for the IRS to have the ability to verify any transaction. So whether he paid any tax on it or not is simply not, it's not determined.
Well, I'm less impressed with that argument. I mean, if that were clearly there on Schedule C and the government was actually indicting this man under the criminal tax laws for failing to put it on D and paying less income tax, I'd have a real problem. But your other argument is that there is this discrepancy, I take it, and it's
yes,
not even there.
Yes. And that, again, just to reiterate, it would be in the cross-examination of the their accountant who testified and his wife, who is the bookkeeper and financial consultant for the law firm.
I wanted to ask you about use of the wires because I'm concerned to make sure that your position is not inconsistent with that taken by the Supreme Court in its 1944 decision in Kahn versus United States. Once this check for $200,000 was deposited, what difference does it make if somebody put the money on a Pony Express and took it over, or whether they used the wires or whether they somehow moved the money around afterward? Isn't that just all the bank's business?
My position is no. The only way for the bank to get from – it went from Mercantile Bank to, I believe, Bank One. It came from Gary Urban Enterprise Association, the $200,000 check, to Mr. Harris's law firm trust account. The only way for that money to be transferred was by wire.
Well, but so, the same thing was true. You remember the facts of Kahn. In the facts of Kahn, they deposit a check in a bank, and the court says that's it. There's no further – I mean, the fact that the bank may have used mails in that case, or it may have used the wires, is subsequent to the transaction. It's not in furtherance of the scheme. The court describes it as merely incidental and collateral to the scheme and not part of it. So why doesn't that language apply here?
I'll be very candid. I'm not familiar with the facts of that case. And so at this point, I'm not.
Well, the defendants made an argument based on it, so it seems like maybe you should have taken a look.
I understand that it's our position, as a matter of fact, that that wire furthered the fraud, because without the $200,000, the defendants could not have taken the $150,000. And as a matter of course, that's how banks, at least in my mind, transfer money. So they would not have been, if that money wasn't transferred from the bank itself.
Well, I'm just going to point out to you that in Mr. Powell's brief at pages 30 and 31, he makes an argument based on this case, and so I'm a little surprised that you didn't look at it. It goes on for a whole paragraph. In Kahn, corporate officers were accused of having set up a dummy corporation through which to divert profits for their own use, accused of fraudulently obtaining checks that were cashed or deposited. The Supreme Court held the fraud was completed at the point at which the defendants cashed the checks. So, you know, it's not like this was hidden from you.
You know, scheme to defraud requires the making of a false statement or material misrepresentation or the concealment of material fact. In this case, the evidence demonstrates that Dolly Millender was unaware of the details of the transactions. But what I've been wondering is, what evidence is there that her ignorance was the result of misrepresentations or efforts to conceal, as opposed to simply her failure to ask any questions or to involve herself in the details of the transactions? I guess in other words, what specifically was the false statement, the material misrepresentation, or the concealment of material fact here?
As you know, Mr. Harris was the lawyer for the Historical Society, had been a longtime lawyer, and I would think that he would have an affirmative duty to go to her to tell her that, oh, by the way, we're going to take this property as a donation. And because she ran the Historical Society, I would think that she would have to know what was going on. So I think the concealment is the fact that they took title to the property, then held the property, and then as time went on, they sold the property. And I would think that, at least under the disciplinary rules, that he would have an affirmative duty to tell her that. So they, in my mind, they concealed the entire transaction from her. And she was never in a position where she could ask either relevant questions because she never knew. And, in fact, the way the testimony came out is I think she discovered that they owned the building literally weeks before trial through a newspaper article. And she also found out literally weeks before trial that that there had been a $200,000 check, which was ultimately forged by Mr. Harris or somebody with Mr. Harris. So all of that would be, in my mind, material omissions.
There's never been an argument, has there, that she's in some way non-compos mentis or?
No, Your Honor. No. You know, my impressions from the trial is that despite the fact that she was 85 years old, she was very competent.
The transcript seems to show that she's answering responsively to questions that are asked.
Yes. She was very sharp.
She was. Well.
Your Honor, if I could just point out one other key fact. Mr. Truitt, regarding Mr. Powell, or Defendant Powell, indicated that at least in his brief and his argument that his client was not a knowing participant in the scheme. And again, I would suggest what Judge Wood said. There was certainly circumstantial evidence that he was a knowing participant in the scheme. And what I would point to the court is there was a transaction between the Gary Urban Enterprise Association when they completed the purchase order and they provided, the purchase agreement. They provided that purchase agreement to Mr. Powell. It was addressed to Dolly Millender, and he indicated to Joanna Meeks that he was going to take it to the Historical Society. And I would suggest to the court that that would be certainly circumstantial evidence that he, like the others, were keeping Dolly Millender in the dark. And that would be evidence, among other things, that he was a knowing participant in the fraud.
Well, you mean your argument that Powell failed to deliver the purchase agreement or the check to the Historical Society,
right,
although both documents were – well, but if Harris is the attorney for the Historical Society, how do you – why is it improper for Powell to deliver those to Harris?
I think that in certain situations, that would be proper, but you also have to keep in mind that Mr. Powell has known Mrs. Millender for a long time. In fact, he was a student of hers in class, and you know, she even indicated at trial or post-trial that she was very fond of him. And they had regular contact. He was he donated to the Historical Society.
Now, underneath all of this, though, is this notion of the abuse of the 501c3. You know, for all we know, she didn't really care that much about it. Somebody gives property worth, let's just use round numbers, worth $200,000. They're happy. They get their tax deduction for the charitable donation. It gets turned around and sold. Ms. Millender's happy because they wind up with $50,000. The other people, I mean, it seems to me that there's this 501c3 status underneath all of this, and I'm surprised the government wasn't focusing more on that, unless it's perfectly okay, as I rather doubt, to use one status that way.
No, we never felt comfortable with her using the 501c3 status.
Does that violate any tax law?
I believe it does. I believe it does. I can't cite any provision, but clearly it was inappropriate conduct by Mrs. Millender. Obviously, we didn't charge her with that.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mr. Powell facilitated the scheme by arranging for the improper reduction of taxes, you know, according to you. But did that defraud the Historical Society or did that defraud Lake County? In other words, if the reductions for the taxes was a valid one, then the Historical Society would have been deprived of profit to which it was entitled. But it appears that the tax reduction was not proper. And in that case, how was the Historical Society deprived of anything that it would be legally entitled to?
Couple of points. The conspiracy conviction related to the lawsuit that illegally took the property taxes or reduced the property taxes. So it was the county that was defrauded in count two. So you are correct. But there's a point with it's mentioned in our brief. It's in the record. When the agreement was struck between Gary Urban Enterprise Association and the Historical Society, the purchase agreement required actually the Gary Urban Enterprise Association to take on the tax liability.
Uh-huh.
So, in essence, the Historical Society was off the hook at the time of the signing of the agreement, even though the agreement wasn't valid because Mrs.
Well, the most you could say is that the tax reduction may have affected the marketability because somebody who pays $200,000 for something that they're going to have to turn around and pay $6,000 on may be less happy than somebody who pays $200,000 for something that they just have two or, you know,
correct,
something like that. Yeah.
Correct. There are no further questions?
Well, one further question that I have is something that hasn't been argued thus far today, but of course is there's quite a bit in the briefs. And I am somewhat concerned about the court sentencing of Mr. Powell. The court appears to have believed that the sentencing guidelines take into consideration factors such as the defendant's age and health. And I thought that the government's response calls for a very strained interpretation of the court's words.
Your Honor, the record is what it is, and Judge Simon clearly said that, and I don't believe it is an accurate statement. But if you look at page 57...
Wait a minute, Mr. Bell. What the judge says is, after he says he's taken everything into consideration, he says, defendant's age, comma, his lack of a criminal history, comma, his health problems, period. And then he says they're taken into account by the guidelines. The problem with that sentence is it has multiple parts. Because although age and health problems are not taken into account by the guidelines, certainly one's lack of criminal history is, very expressly. So it's a sentence that leaves you unsure. Does he think all three of them are taken into account by the guidelines? Is he just accurately stating that criminal history is taken into account? What's he doing?
I'm not certain, but I believe he cleared it up later on, right before he decided the sentence. If you look at page 57 of the sentencing transcript, he says towards basically at line 18, he said, on the other issues of the defendant's age and his lack of criminal history, I just don't think that those are enough to persuade me that a non-guideline sentence is appropriate in this case. So I think he cleared it up. And then he then goes on to say that this is the sentence that I'm going to issue. I'm in agreement with the court that the first statement, the statement that Judge Wood just read, can be interpreted in different ways. But I think he cleared it up on page 57. Thank you.
Three and a half minutes.
Try not to talk too fast.
Three and a half minutes.
Taking the last issue that was discussed first, under Mr. Bell's theory that Judge Simon cleared it up, when he says a non-guideline sentence would be, or something other than a non-guideline sentence, other than a guideline sentence would be appropriate, would indicate an improper thumb on the scale of the guidelines.
I mean, a judge can say, as long as he recognizes he can go anywhere he wants to, that he would prefer to give a guideline sentence. Judges say that every day.
Correct.
As long as he's not making any presumptions, but I don't see presumptive language here.
Well, I didn't argue that it was presumptive. My argument was that he was procedurally unreasonable in thinking that age and health were encompassed in the guidelines, which clearly they are not.
As far as you go with that, you're right. But the problem is, as I pointed out, that sentence also refers to criminal history, and maybe he just should have slowed down when he was talking and been a little more precise.
Well, and I don't think, at least I and Mr. Bell concedes as well, that we're not mind readers. And I guess that that would speak, and I know the Sixth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, have issued cases giving district courts very detailed procedures for how to sentence, guideline calculation, any departures, which of course this court is just wrapped into variances, and then under the parsimony provision in Kimbrough, another evaluation under the statute. I guess my point being that that would speak to the need for procedurally district courts to give very detailed sentencing statements so it's clear, so we're not up here wondering whether or not he thought that that was encompassed in the guidelines or not. The only for sure way, Your Honor, as I point my reply brief, is to go back and ask him on a remand. Getting to some of getting to the points on the use of the wires that the court was asking Mr. Bell, I point out in both in my main brief with Kahn, Mays, had. And this would have been Mr. Harris, because Mr. Powell never touched the check, opened an account at the exact same bank as GIA. All of a sudden, there's no federal jurisdiction, we're not here, even though it's the exact same conduct. Once that check was issued, that's a negotiable instrument under the Uniform Commercial Code. At that point, just like in Kahn, it's a completed transaction.
But here's the difference I saw between the facts in Kahn and your facts. In Kahn, the defendants take the check to the bank and they cash it. They walk away with cash in their hand, which made me think that 1944 was probably a kinder and gentler time than today, because when you put a check in the bank today, they usually say you have to wait a few days before we're going to give you the money. But that is actually one difference. Today, Mr. Harris would have given the check to the bank, and the bank would have said, we're not going to let you draw on this check until after, effectively, we've collected it. So the use of the wires, the wiring of the money from the drawee bank, has to happen. And furthermore, the deal still isn't over, because they still have to divide the money up among the various participants, according to the government's theory. So I wondered whether that is a distinction with Kahn that matters.
It is a distinction. How significant as far as federal liability, I guess, is the question,
for
the court.
Exactly.
And whether or not, oftentimes when we talk about furtherance, we talk about the making a transaction appear legitimate when it's not, to dupe an unknowing person. And in this case, that was not done. It was not given the air of legitimacy simply by that wire. And lastly, I would just point the court to footnote 7 in my reply brief as far as a rebuttal to each one of the government's assertions on how Mr. Powell was a knowing participant. Time, obviously, is would not allow me to go into detail. Thank you very much.
Just briefly, Your Honors, with regard to one of the comments made by the government on I think it brings us to the point of distinguishing between business collaboration and conspiracy. Legitimate business acts may have some factors that overlap the concept of conspiracy, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's a conspiracy. We think on the question of whether or not for instance, Mr. Harris's taxes were believed by the jury. The government, we believe, would have had the burden to demonstrate that taxes were not paid, and that was clearly not the government's theory throughout the record. I was not trial counsel, and I believe Mr. Truitt was not trial counsel in this case. But throughout the record, that is a recurring theme. In fact, the witnesses go on to explain what difference it makes if you file on Schedule C as opposed to Schedule D.
So you don't think the government really properly preserved just a flat-out failure-to-pay argument?
A big project.
You don't think the government properly preserved a simple failure-to-pay or failure-to-report argument?
Not with regard to Mr. Harris. I think that's absolutely true. But they never proceeded on that. The jury never had the occasion to decide just that. And with regard to the sentencing,
would we be able to see that in instructions to the jury? I mean, I don't think this has been developed actually on either side as well as it should have been.
You say, did we have?
What did the instructions to the jury tell the jury about the tax count?
Judge, I'm not sure what that particular instruction said on that. You said I wasn't trial counsel.
Right.
That wasn't one of the issues that was raised, but. We believe the record as a whole clearly indicates what the government's theory was with regard to Mr. Harris's tax account, and not paying at all wasn't it. Just one other thing on the section 3553 sentencing issue. Mr. Harris received 57 months, same conduct as Mr. Powell, same exact criminal history. We believe that 861 allows that the judge, in fact, requires the judge to be sure that sentencing parity, not just see if there's coincidentally a parity and side by side comparisons, we think have not been prohibited by this court. We think in U.S. versus Mendoza, 457 Fed 3rd 726, U.S. versus Boscarino, 437 Fed 3rd 634. Those cases go into the analysis of comparability between co-defendants or co-appellants. So the nationwide comparison with a particular defendant is not the only way to determine whether or not there was fair sentencing in terms of same conduct, same general characteristics, notwithstanding whether or not a person's age and health may be some reasons to not depart nowadays, I guess, but to go less than what the guidelines bottom number would have been. If you compare Mr. Harris and Mr. Powell, the only difference that the sentencing judge makes between the two, frankly, is that Mr. Harris was a lawyer. And we don't think that's enough for that kind of disparity.
What about obstruction?
Hey, pardon?
Obstruction of justice. That was an enhancement, wasn't it?
The court did allow, I guess, an enhancement is what they call it for obstruction of justice. But what that was based on, Judge, was the presumption that there was first of all a violation of the tax code itself by not reporting. It was also based on we think something that there wasn't sufficient evidence on, that there was concealment.
There was a difference. I'm just pointing out there was a different issue than under Mr. Powell.
Oh yes, we agree that issue was not present. Yeah. But even considering that issue by itself would not have generated that disparity, 57 months as opposed to 55 months as opposed to 37.
All right. Thanks to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.